Check, check, here we go. He's not here today, but I would really like to give Hunter's dad another hand clap for the great messages he gave us last week. You know, I don't know if it was like God's timing, but you guys got hit with two messages about complaining in like 3 weeks between he and I. And it reminded me that about 20 years ago, my pastor at the time, he did a series on complaining. And one of the challenges he issued us was to try to go for 3 weeks in a row without complaining about anything. Because apparently, if you can do something for 21 days, you can start a new habit. And so if you can get into a habit of complaining, you can also get into a habit of not complaining. And so his message was that if you're 6 days in and you complain, you got to start over and go another three weeks. So I'm here to tell you I'm still on day one, 20 years later. And so those complaining messages are timely because it's hard to escape complaining. And I also say that to let you know that you're not allowed to complain about my message today in case you were thinking about it. Because I'm going to be doing at least a couple weeks on something that can be frustrating people, and it's about embracing change. This was a message intended to, you know, be given a couple of weeks ago. And then Hunter's dad came in, so I've shoved it back to today, or it got pushed back today, but I think it was God's timing for that. And so I know that just by bringing up that title and that topic, I may lose some of you because we don't like talking about change. So if your mind is tempted to disengage from this topic, I want to ask you to try to focus and stay with me as we go through some scriptures, because I know for many people the idea of changing things is frustrating, just the suggestion of it, because most of us do not like the prospect of change, do we? Because it's disturbing for us to try to think about the unknown when it comes to change. So even if we think our current situation could be better, at least we know what our current situation is. We don't know what the unknown is. At least we're familiar with it. So, but even when our situation is terrible, it's not easy to change. You know, here at the end of December, I saw a lot of people complaining about how terrible 2017 was. I don't know if some of you guys saw and heard that. And then once the calendar flipped over and it was January, I saw people posting, it's a new year, it's going to be a new me. And then now we're at the end of the month, I see those people complaining about how terrible 2018 is already. And it's because they're making the same decisions in 2018 that made their 2017 terrible. They didn't change anything. They say, new year, new me, same decisions, same results. And it's because that even when we know things need changed, it's painful to change them because we're used to doing things a certain way. Change is scary. Most of us also don't like the process of change. Once we get into our mind, we've made the scary decision to change. Now we have the difficult task of learning new things if we change. We're having to abandon our comfort zone. We're fumbling around as we're, you know, experimenting with some things. We're making mistakes under a new system that we never used to make under an old system. You know, sometimes changes make us feel inept because we were grizzled veterans at the old way of doing things. Now we're a brand new rookie at a new way of doing things. I'm going through this. My industry is like completely changing. And so the way I've been doing things for 20 years in my industry, if I keep doing them that way, I won't exist in a few years. So I'm having to learn an entire new way of doing things that's frustrating and scary to me because it's easier just to do things the way I've done them for the last 20 years of my job. Now everything's going to be different. But if I don't change, I won't exist. So it's important that I do change. Most of us, however, even though we don't like the prospect of change, we don't like the process of change, we do like the product of change, right? If we're honest, we can say that most change comes about alongside of progress. Now, I know we all have anecdotes of where a change set us back or hurt us or caused us pain or made things worse, but for the most part, we change things because there are new ways to make them better. And once we get through a change, we're glad we did it. You know, for our congregation example, you know, there were some people that didn't like the idea of building on this new sanctuary because they really loved the old sanctuary. They'd been there for decades. It meant a lot to them. There's sentimental value involved to it. But I also think about, would we really like to have, you know, back when we were really growing from that little place, did we like it when we had 150 people sitting on top of each other on the little pews? You really got to know your neighbor a lot because your legs were touching, your elbows were touching. You knew if they had had deodorant that day. You were all over each other. And during the summer, it'd be about 105 degrees in there. If we just stayed in there, I mean, the biggest change this church has ever made is building the sanctuary, right? If we just stayed in there, there's probably 1,000 people that we wouldn't have connected with in the community that have been through this new sanctuary. So we like the new sanctuary now that it's done. It's comfortable. It's roomy. It gives us more ability to do ministry that we couldn't do before. But the process, the prospect of changing is really difficult. But I haven't heard at this point anyone ready to say, hey, let's abandon this building. Let's go back to the old way. At the time, it was tough for some people. But now, once we've gotten through the changes, we're usually glad that we did it. I mean, if we wouldn't have made that big change, probably, like I said, about 1,000 people probably wouldn't have gotten connected to our church. So today, we are going to talk about one of the most important figures in not just biblical history, but world history. And we're going to see how his decisions, both good and bad, have absolutely shaped the world we live in. And so we're going to go to Genesis 12, 1 through 4. And it says this, the Lord, and anytime in the Old Testament you see the Lord in capital letters, it's using God's covenant name, Jehovah. The Lord said to Abram, go from your country, your people, and your father's household to the land I will show you. I will make you into a great nation, and I will bless you. I will make your name great, and you will be a blessing. I will bless those who bless you and curse those who curse you. And all the peoples of the earth will be blessed because of you. So Abram went as the Lord had told him. And I really want to start with verse 4. Abram went. Because if Abram didn't go, I wouldn't have a sermon to give today. The important thing here is that when God said go, Abram went. And so the purpose of this message is to kind of say we need to be willing to go. We can't have our feet dug in and just say, no, God, I'm not going anywhere. I'm staying right here. And so what this passage doesn't give in 12 is Abram's background. 11 goes into a little bit, but Abram, he and his family were from Ur in Chaldea. And you might remember those two terms from like your middle school history classes when you were being taught about Mesopotamia and the cradle of civilization. That's that area. And they had moved from Ur, which is in modern-day Iraq, you know, the big city, the metropolitan area, down into what is kind of modern-day Syria and Israel and Lebanon, Jordan, sort of a mix of that region. And so they left the big city and they went down there, and their family were farmers, and they were doing well. They went down to this place, they left the city, and they were thriving. In a desolate area. A lot of people probably didn't fare as well. If you've seen pictures of the Middle East, you know their soil doesn't look like Illinois soil, does it? It looks like a beach almost. It's rocky. It's arid. They don't have a lot of moisture. It's not healthy soil, but Abram's family, they were doing well with their herds. And so a lot of their neighbors were probably struggling, but Abram's family was doing well in this spot. They had it good. And I'm telling you this part of the story because I'm planning on using Abram's family as a metaphor for our church today. Because I hope you all agree, our church is blessed. Right? We are. It's easy to make that comparison. I started attending this church 8 years ago. And in the last 8 years, 32,000 churches in America have shut their doors forever. At the same time, we have nearly tripled in size. As far as regular attendees. The same time that 32,000 churches have closed, that doesn't even mention the people that shrunk. I mean, thousands more churches have shrunk. In that same period, we've been blessed to almost triple. And again, we touch probably 1,000 people in this area as far as family members, people who visit and come back and forth or get counseling from us. So we touch a lot of people. And also, our neighboring churches, some of them have struggled. While we've grown, some of them have had issues maintaining people. And I'm not saying that I don't want that for them. You know, we pray as leaders that all the churches in Hoopston would be full, overflowing. They are not our competitors. They're our brothers and sisters. We want them to be healthy. We want them to be thriving and growing. But the fact is, they're not right now. We pray for them for that, but we're like Abram's family. Our congregation has managed to do well in sort of a desolate time for churches. And I'm not saying this is for everybody, but there are predictors for dead and dying churches, and one of them is an unwillingness to change. If you look at churches that have died already or that are dying, an unwillingness to change is a major factor in their problems. And really, it's not just churches. The same can be said for other organizations. How many of you this year did all your Christmas shopping in the Sears Christmas catalog? How many of you used to, right? Of course. Hunter, the Christmas Sears catalog was a catalog they used to send out to people, and you would shop out of it. You would have to call in an order, and they would mail you stuff. And about 1993, about the same time that online shopping started taking over, they printed the last Sears Christmas catalog. Now, for years and years, everybody, how many people remember when Sears was the biggest retailer in the world? Right? They were everywhere. And now where were they at? They bounced from bankruptcy court to bankruptcy court. They didn't adapt. They didn't change. They said, you know, we started this in the 1880s. We're number one. We're going to plug ahead. And now they barely exist. How many of you this weekend rented a video from Blockbuster? Hunter, Blockbuster video, you used to have to drive to a store and you'd pick out a movie off the shelf and then you'd pay for it and take it back to your house and you'd have to drive it back to the store and turn it in. So you had to rewind it. There was a late fee. So Blockbuster started in 1984, 85, and just a few years they grew to 9,000 stores. They ended up being worth about $8.5 billion. They did $800 million in late fees alone. Did you realize that? I probably still owe them like $20 if they ever send me a bill for it for videos I didn't turn in on time. But Blockbuster was the Goliath of the home entertainment industry. They were everywhere. Everybody had a membership to Blockbuster. And then along comes a little company called Netflix with their sling and their five stones, and they tell Blockbuster customers, hey, you don't have to leave your house anymore. We'll mail you DVDs. And Blockbuster at one point had the chance to buy Netflix, and they decided, no, we're number one. We're going to keep doing it our way. And then Netflix said to their customers, you know what, you don't have to wait for us to mail your DVDs anymore. We're just going to stream it right to your TV and your phone. You can just sit on your couch and stream all of our movies for one price, and you'll never have a late fee. And then by the time Blockbuster tried to catch on to this, they lost all their customers. They tried to adapt. It was too late. Everyone was gone. Blockbuster doesn't exist anymore. After being the number one company in the world, they're gone. Because they decided, we don't have to change. We're number one. We're going to keep plugging away. And so now they're gone. They're broke. You know, the little phrase, we've never done it that way before, winds up on the tombstone of a lot of dead organizations. Not just churches, but it happens to video stores. It happens to retailers. If we refuse to make any changes, we're just waiting for a funeral. So let's leave Blockbuster alone for a few minutes. We're going to go back to Abram. It says in verse 1, the Lord said to Abram, go from your country, your people, your father's household, to the land I will show you. Now, I've already mentioned that Abram and his family, they're successful where they're at. They're doing well. And when you're doing well, the last thing you want to be told is, let's do something different. Abram was successful, and then God says, you're going to leave this. You're going to leave this all behind. Well, that doesn't make sense when you have a working formula to do that in your mind, right? Does anybody remember New Coke? New Coke? Hunter, New Coke in the 80s, Coke had the number one drink in the world. They tried to change the formula, and it blew up in their face. And so I imagine if anybody goes to Coke today and says, you know, let's try to change some ingredients, they're probably going to be pretty gun-shy. And so there are stories like that when people think about change. Well, look, it can really backfire you on you if you try to change things that are working. But that's what God told Abram to do. And if I were Abram, I wouldn't want to change. You know, I've got the comfort of my family. I've got the farm that's working good. I have plenty of money. Why do I need to go to a new land, God, when the one I'm working is doing fine, when the way I'm doing things is working fine? Why shift gears when things are good? And we could say the same thing when it comes to us adapting and changing. Why would we do anything different now than we've done for the last 8 years? Why, when 32,000 other churches have closed and we have grown, why would we shift? Why, when, you know, we have the newest building, we have the nicest chairs, we have as many people as every other church in Hoopston combined, why do we need to ever think about altering things? Why would we want to change? What else could we need? How much bigger could we get? Well, we need to think about the Blockbuster story for one thing, because, you know, Netflix would like to drive us out of business too. Because Netflix would much rather you be at home right now streaming their movies than coming to church on Sunday mornings. It's a lot easier when it's 10 below in Hoopston to stay in your bed and binge watch The Office on your phone than to get out of bed and come to church. So Netflix has got it in for us too. We need to take an example from a company like Blockbuster. Jesus said that we are to be fishers of men. The last time I went fishing was 1990, but I know that I had to put bait on the hook to get the fishes to come to me. You don't just throw out an empty line and hope the fish will crawl up on the shore to you. You have to offer people things that they're going to eat. You have to offer something that looks appetizing. We have to offer something that appeals to them so they want to bite into the hook. Then God says, I will make you into a great nation, and I will bless you. So when God was asking Abram to give up his current comfort, give up his farm, give up his success, it'd be easy for Abram to say, God, why are you taking this away from me? I've been blessed with this stuff. Why would you take all this away from me? But God wasn't taking anything away from Abram. He was clearing out things from Abram's life so he could offer him a bigger blessing. He wasn't taking things from Abram. He was clearing space in Abram's life for more. God was saying, yeah, Abram, right now you've built yourself a nice family farm, but I desire to build you a nation. God didn't want Abram to have a farm-sized blessing. He wanted Abram to have a nation-sized blessing. But he couldn't get a nation-sized blessing staying on the farm, doing things the way he'd always done, doing things that worked. If he wanted a nation-sized blessing, he had to leave the farm and go to a new land. Again, God has blessed this church. You know, this church is over 100 years old. And maybe some of you have seen the pictures of the little tiny building this congregation started with just a handful of people. If you'd have told those original 10 to 12 people, well, you know, in 2018, we're going to do two services. We're going to have this big facility. We're going to, you know, average 250, 300 people every week. We're going to touch the lives of 1,000 people. They'd have been amazed by that. And Sadie Evans, who's kind of like a Church of God historian, she caught me after first service, and she was telling me, I remember, you know, when I was growing up here, we had to have, you know, we'd have 30 people. She said, me and Debbie Klaber were the whole youth group. And she said, we'd have 30 people here, and 1 week we got up to 60 people. We didn't know what to do. And then during a real bad time of the Depression, when everyone was hungry, we had 80 people show up to church, and they freaked out. And I've heard stories from her, from other people, about our brothers and sisters decades ago in small buildings when they bought this property. We had people turning off their heat and skipping dinners to put money into a building fund and a property fund for a building they would never see. This land, this building, was kicked off decades ago by people who've never seen it. They would hold back meals and give money to a building fund. They would turn their heat down in the winter and give money to a building fund they never saw. And I was being told, between services, Debbie Klaber's dad, who was a leader in the church, he would emphasize, this giving isn't for us. It's for other people. It's not about what we're going to have today. It's about we're giving towards other people in the future. But the reason we sit here today in this nice facility is because people decades ago didn't care about their own comfort. They cared about us having the ability to do ministry. So they sacrificed their comfort. Don't you think they'd like to have a warmer house in the winter? Don't you think they would have liked to have more food in their belly? They were looking forward to future ministry. And so they sacrificed what they wanted then so we would have this today. We need to be mindful of that. They would have never imagined walking in this building today when they were used to going into a cramped little space. They said you'd walk down the stairs and everybody would hit their head on some wooden beam because it wasn't built right. And so 10 or 12 people would huddle in a little building, scrape together what money they could, and just add to it. And they started giving to this property, and they never even got to see it or use it. But here we are with it. And so as surprised as they would be, you know, thinking we're talking about, you know, the old days when this used to be a 30-person church. Wouldn't it be nice in the future if we were looking back and saying, do you remember when we only had 300 people? Wouldn't that be shocking? Man, we were so small then. We only had 300 people. We only had two services at that time. We used to meet in a little brown and blue sanctuary that we use for a closet now. God was offering Abram to give up his farm-sized blessing and have a nation-sized blessing. But he had to give up the current way he was doing things. He had to not lean on his past victories. He had to not worry about his preferences. In order for Abram to go and get his nation-sized blessing, he had to be thinking about the future, not just what was good for him right there. So he had to give up the farm-sized blessing to attain the nation-sized blessing. Then God says in the next verse, I will make your name great and you will be a blessing. This is an important part of the promise too. God wasn't just going to bless Abram more. He was. But he said, also, Abram, after I bless you, I'm going to use you to be a blessing for others. So part of the change that Abram was to make was for other people. It wasn't just for him. God was planning on using Abram to bless others. The way Abram was doing things was fine, but he was only blessing his family at the time, wasn't he? His little family was circled up on their land with their crops, with their farm, with their animals. They were doing well. He wasn't blessing anybody else. So God says, I'm going to make your name great so I can bless others through you. We ought to think about that as a church too. We ought to want that as a church. We ought to revel at the idea and the opportunity, the challenge that God would elevate us in this area so that when people have a spiritual crisis, they come to the church of God first because they've heard that we're willing to minister to them. And when I'm thinking about our name being great, I'm not talking about attaining celebrity. I'm talking about building a reputation in our community that people know they can trust us. You know, Solomon wrote that a good name is to be desired more than gold. And that's not like having, you know, Fred or John or Tom like that. That's not what he means by good names. He means a name that is recognized for goodness and godliness and service and love. We want to be known in our community as that kind of people, that they come to us first because they know that we're going to minister to them, we're going to love them, we're going to accept them. I mean, think about how many hundreds of people have been in and out of this building in the last 8 years as visitors, during weddings, during funerals. This week we were opened up for school kids to come in. Having this facility has opened us up to all kinds of ministry that we'd have never had opportunity to do before. We've been able to bless other people because we've gotten bigger. And if we get bigger again, we'll be able to bless even more people. We ought to want that nation-sized blessing. And, you know, even I'm from Danville. And when I talk about the church up here, it is not unusual at all for me here for people to say, yeah, I've heard there's really great things going on at that church in Hoopston. I mean, God has made our name great in a lot of areas. But he can take it from a farm-sized blessing to a nation-sized blessing if we're willing to make changes. We have to be willing to go sometimes. Then God says to Abram, I will bless those who bless you, and I will curse those who curse you. This is where God starts speaking to our fears about changing. Abram was being called away from his place of comfort and familiarity to a place that was totally unknown. I don't know if you realize in verse 1, when Abram is told to go, God didn't give him an address. God didn't give him an outline to follow. God didn't give him a final destination. He says, go, and I will show you. That was the whole plan. Abram, just go, and I'll show you. Not knowing where you're going is one of the scariest parts about change. It's hard to give up things that are familiar to us and easy to us, things that we can repeat without even thinking about it. Again, even when our behavior is destructive, it's easier to stick with the same behavior than to think about changing our behavior because, well, I at least know what this decision is going to bring me. Even if it hurts, I know what it is. I'm comfortable with it. I'm used to it. But trying something brand new, we get worried about, well, what if this decision is going to be even worse? We're scared about trying things that we're unfamiliar with. But God says, if when you go, I'm going to protect you. I'll bless those who bless you. I'll curse those who curse you. I'm on your side. I'm going with you, he says. And I don't know if you ever think about this. You know, the Jewish people today are the descendants of Abram. And it's shocking that there's a Jewish people left on earth, isn't it? Because they were just one little tribe. This is the beginning of the Jewish people's story. Here, Abram's calling. And in their history, they have been targeted for destruction by multitudes of people who are bigger and stronger and more sophisticated and more well-equipped. You go back to the Old Testament, you think about, you know, the Philistines attacking them and the Hittites attacking them and the pharaohs of Egypt and Assyria and Persia. You think about Alexander the Great and Greece attacking them, the Roman Empire attacking them. You know, more modern times, you think about Nazi Germany trying to wipe out the Jews. The Soviet Union had a purge of Jews. All those cultures are gone. Those mighty nations, these great empires, they're all gone, and the Jewish people are still there. They've been targeted for destruction over and over again, and they're still here. That little tribe, Abraham's family, that God promised to protect, they're still here. All these great nations are gone. All their armies are gone. And there's Israel. So if we need to process that too. If God is willing to protect Abram and his descendants when he was obedient and went, won't he protect us when we go, when we try new things, when we follow his leading? All peoples on earth will be blessed through you. Now, I don't know if Abram, who was later called Abraham, could have possibly understood everything that God was intending to do through this new nation. But God had something way more important than just blessing Abram's money and farm and crops when he's talking about this promise. The book of Matthew has a really interesting beginning, and it goes like this in Matthew 1:1. This is the genealogy of Jesus the Messiah, the son of David, the son of Abraham, which means the descendant of Abraham. Now, I'm sure that God would have worked it out, but what if Abram would have told God, no, I'm not going. I'm really happy doing things the way I've been doing them. I like it here on the farm. I appreciate that you would like to bless me. I appreciate that you want to make my name great, but I'm really just comfortable the way I've been doing things. So God, give that blessing to somebody else. The way my family's doing it is working fine. We have a good life. The only reason we've ever heard of Abram is because he went. Verse 4, he went. God said go, Abram went. That's the only reason we've ever heard of him. And through him, the whole earth was blessed through Jesus because he went. And our commission as individual believers and as a congregation is to take the name of Abram's most famous descendant into all the world and bring them the blessing of salvation through Jesus. We're continuing the process of all people on earth being blessed through Abram. And I used to hear people summarize the purpose of the church by saying that we are to know him and to make him known. And when we make him known, that's how we spread the blessing to people on all earth. But to do that, we can't stay on the farm. We have to be willing to go. We have to be willing to expand. We have to be willing to go new places and do new things. Hebrews 11 writes this about Abram. By faith, Abraham, when called to go to a place he would later receive as his inheritance, obeyed and went, even though he did not know where he was going. By faith, he made his home in the promised land like a stranger in a foreign country. He was looking forward to the city with foundations whose architect and builder is God. And so from this one man, and he as good as dead, came descendants as numerous as the stars in the sky and as countless as the sand on the seashore. All these people were still living by faith when they died. They did not receive the things promised. They only saw them and welcomed them from a distance. Abram never got to see the promise of Jesus, did he? It was 28 generations later that Jesus was born as one of his descendants. But now the whole earth is blessed through Abram because he said yes to God. He went. Those people that scrimped and saved and gave to the cause of this church decades ago, they didn't get to see this promise fulfilled. They welcomed it from far off, but they sacrificed their comfort. They sacrificed their money. They sacrificed their possessions so that we would be blessed by their work. We're reaping their blessing. We're reaping what they sowed. And we need to be thinking about what we're doing to set up the next generation. That way the next generation can look back and say, we were only 250 people in 2018. That's all we had, only 250 people. Weren't we little back then? Wasn't our reach limited back then? Weren't our resources limited back then? We need to be setting up the next generation like the previous generation set us up. They weren't thinking about what made them comfortable. They were thinking about the future. We need to be thinking about the future, the generation that's coming to this congregation afterwards. Because we don't want our children and grandchildren to be the ones to board this building up, do we? I want this sanctuary to be used as a storage closet for their new big sanctuary. This might be where they store the chairs or something. But we ought to be thinking about the church we're going to leave behind to them, the ministry of this area we're going to leave behind to them. We're poised not to be a Hoopston town church. We're poised to be a regional church. And we ought to be thinking about a vision like that. We're not just a Hoopston church anymore. We have people that come from other towns now. This is not just a Hoopston church. But we can reach out even farther. We have more potential than any other congregation around this area to do ministry on a region-wide basis. But we can't do it by just saying, well, I'm going to use the 2015 strategy in 2025 and 2030. We don't want to look back on the last 8 years as the golden era of this church, do we? We want the future to be better than it is today. We want the reach to be bigger. We want the name to be greater. And if we don't do these things, if we don't set up the coming generation, then we're robbing them of their inheritance. We're robbing them of their ministry. We're robbing them of their name. And, you know, I didn't really research it, but I can't think of one story in the Bible where God says, I'm going to bless you for sitting still and trying nothing new. Maybe some of you can think of one. I can never remember God telling somebody, I'm going to bless you for maintaining the status quo. I'm going to bless you for staying where you're most comfortable and not stretching yourself. I can't remember one story throughout the entire Bible like that. Can you? every blessing comes after a challenge to grow, a challenge to try something new that you've never done before. Never stagnation. God does not bless stagnation. You know, God, the Bible talks about living water being a good thing versus a stagnant pond where things just stay there until they die. Living water is constantly providing growth, providing health, providing cleansing. A pond, things just go in there and die. We want to be part of that living water. And so if we want to be a vibrant church, we can't just dig in our heels and say we're going to keep plugging away the same way we've done things for the last 8 years. We have to be willing to adapt especially to the needs of the culture. Paul said that to the Jews he became a Jew, to the Greeks he became a Greek so that he could save some. So he adapted his delivery methods so that he could be effective to his local culture. And so that's what we should always advocate. You know, there's a difference between a product and a package. You know, if you go buy a Snicker bar inside, you know, at the store, you're wanting the good Snicker bar inside. But the packaging is still important. The packaging tells you about what the product is. The packaging makes the product either appealing or unappealing. If you go somewhere where a product, the packaging looks terrible, you're not likely to buy it, even if the product is really good. And conversely, people will go and buy some junk product if the packaging looks really nice. Our product is Jesus. Our product is the gospel. Our product is love. Our product is unity. The packaging is stuff like carpets. The packaging is paint color. The packaging is music style. And we ought to be willing to change the packaging anytime it's necessary to. If the culture dictates that we need to use gangster rap because that's the only reason we can, that's the only way we can reach people, we ought to switch to gangster rap. Somebody pray it doesn't come to that. But if we need to change the clothes, if we need to change the colors, if we need to change the screens, if we need to change the times, that's just packaging. It's just superficial stuff. It's doing whatever we have to do to make sure people want to bite into the good product. God says, taste and see that I'm good. We can make it easier for people to taste and see that God is good by changing the packaging sometimes. So we always need to be willing to change the packaging. The product has to stay the same. We're not going to change what we teach about Jesus. We're not going to change what we teach about salvation. But we've got to package it in whatever way helps us reach the culture around us. And that changes a lot. Church strategy changes a lot. You know, back in the old, you know, decades ago, the way churches would try to grow is they would go set up a tent somewhere in the park and they would have tent revivals. You know who goes to tent revivals today? People who are already saved. That's it. The community doesn't rally to tent revivals anymore. The Church of God, when it started, it used to go up and down rivers on a steamboat, preaching from a boat. We don't really do that anymore. The Church of God never used to allow ties. Now sometimes if you don't wear a tie in the Church of God, they tell you you're not a Christian. The Church of God never used to allow wedding rings because they were worldly. Women, do you ever cut your hair? The Church of God didn't allow you to cut your hair when they first started. They didn't allow you to wear makeup. Please, women, wear makeup. Do your hair. The method's adapted, and it's good that they did. We need to be able to change the packaging. And so whatever we have to do to deliver the gospel, the true gospel today, and for the future health of this church, have an open mind to do that. As we make updates to the facility, as we change programs, as we add classes, as we add teachers, as we do things to change the packaging, worry about the delivery of the product. That's why we change the packaging, is to make the product more deliverable to this culture. This time, I'm going to have the ushers come forward because we're going to get to enjoy the Lord's Supper together and communion together. But as we're delivering this and singing our last song, you can sing and be praying for yourself at the same time. You can be praying to digest the message, understand the word, digest Abram's story, clear things up with God. If you've got some things that you need to deal with the Lord, be doing that. But let's go ahead and pray together and sing together. Father, grateful for your word again, that you give us wisdom, you give us a guide path about how to live and what your will is. We pray as we sing this last song, God, that you would just be dealing with us in our hearts and our minds and our spirits, that we would have clarity about what you want and willingness to do what you want. In Jesus' name, amen.